From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
Donald Trump is in England, meeting with Prime Minister Theresa May and the Queen. He's also creating enormous political headaches for May, attacking her handling of Brexit at a time when her prime ministership is already under threat. Trump also clashed with our allies at the NATO summit in Brussels. What exactly does he think he's trying to achieve in Europe? Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein dropped a bombshell: indictments of 12 Russian intelligence officials for the 2016 hack of the DNC. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, as predicted, it's Brett Kavanaugh for SCOTUS. Nick Bagley of Michigan Law School tells us what we should make of Kavanaugh's record on challenges to Obamacare. And Annie Lowrey makes a pitch for universal basic income. Her new book is called Give People Money, and she's proposing to do exactly that. All that plus the future of the EU and NATO is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, also a columnist at The Washington Post. As we tape, Donald Trump is in England, taking meetings with Prime Minister Theresa May and the Queen. He's also on the front page of The Sun, a major conservative English tabloid newspaper. He told The Sun several ways he thinks Theresa May is doing a bad job. She disregarded his advice on negotiating a Brexit deal, and her proposed deal, he says, will kill the US-UK trade deal she hopes to negotiate with him. He also said May's proposal isn't what the British people voted for when they approved Brexit, that it's too soft. May was already under severe criticism within her own party over this proposal, so Trump is pouring gasoline on the fire of a political crisis she already faced. Right before meeting with her, how awkward. At a joint press conference with May on Friday, Trump said his interview with The Sun, of which there is an audio recording, is, quote, fake news. The mess in England comes after the fights the president picked in Brussels at the NATO summit, haranguing our allies to repay their so-called NATO debts to the U.S. and suggesting the U.S. might otherwise go its own way. Trump also claimed NATO members agreed to further raise their spending targets on military spending, a claim that French President Emmanuel Macron promptly denied. To make sense of all of this, we're joined by Tom Nuttall. Tom writes The Economist's weekly Charlemagne column, which is about European politics and economics, and he joins us from Brussels. Welcome, Tom.
Hi there.
So how should we think about how this is going over in England, the American president during his official visit telling the prime minister she's doing her job all wrong?
I mean, it's not a great look. The headline in The Sun appears literally day before this state visit begins. But on the other hand, it sort of disentangled the various elements of this. Perhaps the one that people are talking about most is what he said about how Theresa May's particular proposal for how to do Brexit, what the implications that that would have for a potential US-UK trade deal. On this particular point, the president is absolutely right. Basically, the point is that we now have, as of about a week ago, a specific proposal from the British government for alignment with European rules on industrial goods and for agricultural goods, which means that there'll be a sort of what they call a common rule book. So Britain will stay part of the European single market for those particular sectors. That pretty much by definition means that Britain cannot align itself with American rules. There's there's different regulatory spaces that you can occupy, and Britain under this proposal has chosen to occupy the one with Europe. That will make it very, very difficult to strike any sort of ambitious trade deal with the United States, particularly with very strong farm lobbies. Certain congressmen are very tough on some of these things. So, some of the reporting, I think, of this has been a little bit off. It sort of suggested this is Trump taking a very tough line. It's America first. He's not going to treat Britain any better than anyone else. That's not really the point. It really just sort of follows from this specific British proposal that if there's going to be a greater degree of alignment with Europe on certain things, there's going to be less alignment with America, and therefore the ambitions for a trade deal are going to have to be scaled back.
Megan, Liz, what do you make of this? I mean, you have this, what Tom describes there, you have a substantive concern about a trade deal, but then you also have these matters of style and protocol. And the president, it seems like he has to have realized when he gave this interview the manner in which it was going to affect this visit. So even if he has this particular concern, doesn't this look more like he's just trying to create a problem?
I think that's not quite the right way to put it, because I don't think that Trump tries to create problems so much as doesn't care whether he does create problems, right? Is that, like, Trump cares about a very narrow range of things, mostly the positive attention he gets from his U.S. base and the very negative attention that he gets from the media, right? And those are the things that he focuses on. He loves getting this attention from the media. The media feeds it, and he gleefully provides because then his base loves it. And so I think that's the right way to frame it, which is that he, you know, the biggest risk to this administration has always been foreign policy, precisely because the president has so much power to screw it up, sort of unhindered by any advisors or bureaucracy. And because Trump fundamentally does not have a theory of geopolitics, nor very much interest in it.
Liz?
Yeah. I mean, the nationalist game plan is always to talk a big game about subduing capital and making it submit to the nation. And that's Trump's thing. But then at the same time, kissing and playing footsie with it.
But does this serve the interests of capital? I mean, I think, you know, the international trade regime that Trump is causing a wide variety of disruptions to, capital doesn't seem thrilled about that.
No, I mean, that's the thing. I think Trump is basically an aesthetic creature. He's just here to cause problems in terms of protocol and to mouth and yak. And like Megan said, at that point, he just gets a lot of attention for it. And I mean, it's sort of entertaining on one hand, because transnational capital has been super governmental for so long now that it's actually kind of entertaining to see someone try to, at least on the aesthetic level, disrupt the patterns of transnational capital. I mean, that's kind of fun, even though it's not going to do anything in the long run. It's nice to see them sweat. I mean, because no one ever messes with them. At the same time, it's not like a popular movement. It's not going to do anything, because that's not actually what Trump has in mind. And at the end of the day, his government is very friendly to capital.
Well, so Tom, where does that leave us in terms of, as you know, the UK, there was enough tension over this Brexit matter even before Trump involved himself in it. Trump is very unpopular in the UK. Does this actually in some way strengthen Theresa May's hand as she fights off challenges in her own party over her strategy on Brexit? Basically, her opponents therefore have to align themselves with Donald Trump?
Yeah, I mean, maybe to a certain extent. You know, he's caused a bit of trouble by praising Boris Johnson, who until last week was an extremely troublesome foreign secretary for Theresa May.
To give background on that, Boris Johnson, the former mayor of London, had been a top official in Theresa May's government. He quit over this proposal that Theresa May issued, basically saying that it wasn't a hard enough Brexit. It maintained too strong a relationship with Europe. And there's a lot of speculation that he might try to unseat her as leader of the Conservative Party, become prime minister himself. And the president, though he was trying to say that he wasn't taking a position between the two of them, he did sort of go out of his way to say that Boris would be a great prime minister.
Yeah, and he did it twice. He didn't do it only in the interview with The Sun. He actually did it in Washington before he boarded Air Force One on his way to Europe. And it was a sort of a peculiar thing to do. I mean, it just looked like a very deliberate attempt to lob a bomb into what at the time was a very febrile political situation in Britain. Actually, for what it's worth, you know, I think a few days down the line, Theresa May looks a little bit more secure than we might have imagined that she was going to be at the beginning of the week, when not only Boris Johnson, but also her Secretary of State for leading the EU, David Davis, resigned over this plan. Actually, the sort of, you know, I may be proved wrong on this, but I think the sense right now is that the potential for a leadership challenge from some of the so-called hard Brexiteers in the Conservative Party doesn't really look like it's that strong. They basically don't have the numbers in Parliament to present a real challenge to her. To the extent that some people are now saying, you know, she really should have called their bluff a lot earlier, because we're really running out of time now on these Brexit negotiations. She should have cleaned out the stables a bit earlier, got rid of these guys, got a much more unified cabinet, and got on with the negotiations. So I think she's probably a little bit safer than we might have imagined her to be. I think your point about Trump's unpopularity is also well taken. It's not going to be particularly damaging, at least in the sort of the short term kind of public media conversation, for any British politician to make an enemy out of this American president. And indeed, some British politicians, notably Sadiq Khan, who succeeded Boris Johnson as the mayor of London, are going to great attempts to appear on every possible American TV network, telling them about how appalling a president and a man Donald Trump is, because they think that goes down rather well with their electorate. And they're probably not wrong about that.
So if we zoom out and look at not just this turbulent visit to Britain, but what preceded it in Brussels with the NATO summit and the president sort of continuing to harangue other NATO leaders over their insufficient military spending, saying that they now need to spend even more than 2% of their economy on the military, and then sort of sending these contradictory messages, talking about NATO stronger than ever. But there was also this report about the president saying that the U.S. might have to go it alone if the other NATO members won't step it up. What should we make of the challenges to these two institutions? Because, you know, the president has taken this sort of openly antagonistic line about NATO. He, very unusually for an American president, has been talking down the European Union, complaining that the fact that you have the EU bloc prevents the U.S. from making good trade deals from individual members of the EU. What should the U.S. position be on this? Because you're starting to see poll numbers move. A majority of Republicans now saying that the U.S. should withdraw from NATO. What should the U.S. position be on NATO and the European Union?
The thing about foreign policy is that we've had this world order that was created by the United States in the aftermath of World War II. And this is a general thing about all sorts of policy, but particularly foreign policy, is that it's really easy to kind of free ride on that and not, you know, we've had basically peace in Western Europe for 70 years now because of this thing. And it's easy to devalue things that have been working for so long that you basically don't notice that they're there. And I think that that's a general policy problem. And I think that the broader thing that we're seeing is that, like, you have, we used to think that people joined parties because they were ideological, right? You like conservative ideas, and so you join the Republicans. It's now looking increasingly like you sort of pick who's on your team, and then the party leaders just tell you what to believe, and you believe it. And that's true. It seems to be true on both left and right, which means that Donald Trump is actually, to an extent that I think I didn't predict, and a lot of people didn't predict, actually changing the Republican Party in some pretty weird ways. When you've got Republicans not liking a military alliance, that's a pretty surprising development.
You know, I mean, Liz, these are institutions that historically have come under a lot of criticism from the left. In the last few years, we've been hearing a lot of criticism of them from the right, including from Donald Trump. Where do those left critiques lie? Should people on the left be defensive of the EU at this point?
The left critiques are the economic critiques, that the EU is a vast capital bloc. And it allows the EU to function basically as a way for capital to move around these national blocks in a way that labor can't, right? So it just gives capital another way to basically transcend the bounds of government, nation, and labor.
And then the idea is the concern there that you can push down wages because the capital is more mobile than the labor.
Is more mobile than labor and is also able to, you know, in a government-like way, build alliances that labor just can't.
And so should we be pleased to see the sort of the bombs that Donald Trump is throwing into the EU alliance? Is this something that can end well for the left? Or is it likely that if you weaken the EU, the institutions will be replaced by something that is worse from the left's perspective? Well, it's an important question, right?
Well, some of the old-time lefties, the real cowboys, used to say the only way out is through. And you're just going to see a lot of really bad things happen before you see the opportunity for improvement. The decelerationists, the people who are just trying to maintain or sort of manage the decline, I mean, you can certainly, just through a harm reduction type position, argue for that. Like, well, it's going to be really bad if you just start seeing, you know, a very vast and quick breakup of a sort of sustained global order. On the other hand, you know, if what you're saying is right, and peace in Western Europe or an entire global order has only been held together by the United States establishing its own economic and its own military order, in what sense are we not just an empire? And this is just the Pax Romana.
Well, I think Pax Americana is a phrase that has been thrown around a lot, and I think has something, you know, is basically, you know, the United States military power is so outsized that it almost doesn't make sense to try to do direct military competition with us, right? There is no country in the world that can compete because we're so big and so rich, and there are very big countries and very rich countries, but there's no one who has the combination of size and wealth. And I think that that actually has been a force for good. That is not to underweight the bad things we've done with that power. And that is always the risk of this sort of power, is that it gets abused or just used stupidly, as I think we did in Iraq. But the benefit of it is that it doesn't make sense for other people to try to start wars that the United States is likely to intervene in. And that is a great boon to humanity. Right. And it is also true that, like, these blocks, you know, Germany and Europe and Germany and France used to, or France and England, just regularly go to war with each other and kill a ton of people. And having them tied together in an economic community that makes it very, very initially costly to start that kind of effort, that's, I think, also a force for good and peace in the world. It may have other bad side effects, but, you know, we should not underweight that.
Tom, how are people in Europe thinking about these sort of muddling through questions as the U.S. starts to either disengage or actually become problematic? I mean, we're seeing, you know, Brexit proving extremely complicated, more complicated than maybe a lot of its advocates thought that it was going to be. What is the future for these institutions in Europe?
Well, how long have you got? I mean, there's one reason why people were dreading the NATO summit, especially in Berlin, and I think we'll feel that probably a lot of their fears were vindicated. It wasn't so much about this sort of particular question of defense spending that Trump likes to harp on about. The bigger question is that the whole point of something like NATO is that it rests on the sort of the being able to demonstrate to potential adversaries that this is an alliance of trust, of credibility, of solidarity, and of a mutual defense. And once you start to question those sorts of assumptions, and let's remember, this is a very sort of peculiar thing where the United States basically says that it will treat an attack on Estonia as if it is an attack on the United States. Once you start to question that or to suggest that that commitment is no longer as credible as it's supposed to be, as I think Trump is now doing, then you really start to weaken the very foundations of this sort of thing. And so instead of talking about the many actual operational successes of NATO and also dealing with some of the new challenges that are arising, fake news, cyber security, these sorts of things, we end up with this kind of theater where Trump comes in, lobs a bomb, has a go at the allies one by one, starts talking about a 4% target and all the rest of it, sort of it hints that he might want to walk out, and then comes out at a press conference and says everything was wonderful. And this is the only thing that we're talking about. So the alliance is no longer, as it were, taking itself seriously. That's a huge concern for people here. On the trade side of things, which we're going to be hearing more about in the next couple of weeks here, because the president of the European Commission, which is the body that negotiates trade deals on behalf of the EU, is going to be in Washington. That's Jean-Claude Juncker. This is potentially damaging, not only simply because, you know, German car manufacturers are freaking out at the prospect of whopping new tariffs on their exports to the States, but because it has the potential to drive a wedge between European government. And you've already seen some tensions here. And if, as seems likely, Trump wants to ratchet this stuff up by whacking tariffs not only on metals exports, as he's done already, but cars, that's when those tensions between European governments could start to become a lot more serious. And so that's when America shifts from being a kind of a guarantor not only of American security, but of European security, but European unity, to actually becoming a divisive power. The overriding mood here is very sort of tense, worried, sort of despair, gloom, and a lot of not very much clarity about where we're going next.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. I will be back shortly with Megan McArdle and Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Tom Nuttall of The Economist to talk about the indictment that stepped on the news of Trump's meeting with the Queen. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at The Washington Post. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, also a columnist at The Washington Post. And Tom Nuttall of The Economist is still with us. On Friday, just as Donald Trump was meeting the Queen for tea at Windsor Castle, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein held a press conference in Washington, D.C. to announce the indictment of 12 Russian intelligence officials for hacks intended to interfere in the 2016 election. These include the email hack of the Democratic National Committee, a topic I should note I have some personal experience with since a large number of my husband's emails were released in that hack. That was not fun. Rod Rosenstein also noted the indictment alleges various efforts to hack election administration agencies in the United United States and software companies that serve those agencies. Rosenstein noted the indictment does not allege that these efforts affected any electoral outcomes or vote counts. He also said no criminal activity is alleged in this indictment on the part of Americans who communicated with these Russian conspirators about the dissemination of the hacked material. But the announcement makes the idea that the Russian government sought to interfere in the 2016 election not just the position of American intelligence agencies and political officials, but of Trump's own Justice Department, ratified by a grand jury that found probable cause to say Russian officials, not some 400-pound guy in his basement, were behind these hacks. The announcement comes just days before Trump is set to meet with Vladimir Putin in Helsinki. So how does this affect the Putin meeting? You saw the president asked earlier this week about whether he would raise the election interference issue with Putin. And he actually, somewhat surprisingly to me, said he would raise it with him, although he said, as usual, you know, well, you know, maybe he'll just deny it. But so the president apparently had been briefed that this indictment was coming down. It seems like this makes it harder for him to suggest that it's, you know, it's unknown to us whether the Russians really did anything bad here or not.
I think it makes it harder, but with Trump, you know, you never want to count him out. He would like, he, you know, all politicians lie a lot, right? That's sort of the job, because voters want a bunch of contradictory things, and it's a lot easier to promise them if you are just willing to say things that you know are not true. But Trump is at a whole different level of the things that he says, right? Where he not only tells sort of normal, boring political lies, but he will also just like flatly deny things that everyone obviously knows are true and where there is absolutely no wiggle room to say, well, maybe there is some way you could squint at this and see it his way. He just says whatever he thinks is most convenient at the moment. And so I think it is entirely possible that he will simply continue to say that there was no attempt to interfere in the election. And I think that, you know, it's quite possible, too, though, that the left will play into his hands by wildly overreacting to this, right? The interference that we know actually did something are things like the DNC hack and things like the Facebook ads, right? But the amount of credence that people put into a basically trivial number of Facebook ads and like this was playing with people's minds and it was brainwashing them into voting for Trump, right? When you make claims like that, you make it much easier for the president to just say like, look, these people are hysterical. They blow things up out of nothing, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Well, but I think there's two somewhat separate questions here. One is, you know, does this make it a, you know, a so-called illegitimate election, which you hear a lot from people on the left. But the other is how should this affect how we think about our relationship with Russia, even if they fail to significantly affect the outcome of an election. Presumably, it should still bother us that they are conducting these sorts of activities in the United States and maybe influence the way that we deal with them on other matters. I don't know, Liz, what are you looking for out of this meeting?
Trump probably will broach it, and he will probably say that Russia did it and that it was all true. I mean, he has a very, like, clever and flexible relationship with truth. Like, it's kind of, I mean, it's enjoyable to watch, even though he's a madman. And what he'll say is like, yeah, you know, Russia hacked those emails, but they were all real emails. They were really trying to screw Bernie. And that's not my fault. If you don't want to get hacked, don't try to screw Bernie.
Well, what about the broader Russian relationship? Because, I mean, you know, the criticism that you see from the left and from some people who are on the right, although are stridently anti-Trump on the right, is that basically the president has been serving a number of Russian foreign policy objectives here. The weakening of the European Union, the weakening of NATO, flirting with the idea that we will recognize the Russian annexation of Crimea.
Right. Trump's fascination with Russia is that he's basically like on the thin edge of fashing out. And like Russia is more than flirting with that. And so Trump is just he's thrilled by the aesthetics of it. Right. And so he has an affinity for it because he's a romantic figure. He's not a policy wonk. He didn't go into this because he had policy ideas. Guys, he liked the image of himself as president.
Megan, do you buy that? I mean, I find the aesthetic idea interesting in part because Trump's Russia fascination goes back so far as in, you know, he writes about it in The Art of the Deal and his visit to Moscow and how much he enjoyed visiting with the Soviets and he wanted to open a Trump Tower Moscow in partnership with the Soviet government. So I think that there's something about the Russian aesthetic he likes, but I don't know that I buy that it's necessarily a thing about the extreme right nature of it, because when Russia had an extreme left government in the 1980s, Trump seemed taken with that.
Well, also true, most people on the right do not actually think of Nazi Germany as their ideal form of governance.
Or Putin's Russia.
Or Putin's Russia is that... Yes, I think there's absolutely an element of him. Like, right, what is Trump, what is Trump's kind of overarching thing? What does he care about most? Whatever, like, it's really two things. He really cares about being, like, the most dominant dude in the room and having, like, hot women around, right? That is his kind of... And, like, that is a thing that, like, Russian capitalism will provide you. It was a thing that Russian non-capitalism provided the elites at the top. And a lot of people saluting you and bowing down and showing, like, how important and big you are. He loves all that stuff. That is his that is why he did this. And when why he so consistently has nice words for, like, authoritarian leaders, right? They get a lot of attention, people grovel to them, and then they basically go and smite bad guys or, you know, self-identified bad guys, you know, with one smash of their steely fist. That is his idea of what power should be and should look like. And he is, you know, I don't think he's a fascist because I don't think that he has any sort of coherent ideology.
Neither do fascists.
Tom Nuttall writes about European politics and economics for The Economist. Thank you for joining us, Tom.
No problem. Cheers.
Still with me are Liz Brunig on the left and Megan McArdle on the right. Let's talk about Brett Kavanaugh. The president is sometimes unpredictable, but he was not in this instance, where he went with the most often suggested choice from his shortlist. That's Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his next nominee to the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh worked for Ken Starr during the Monica Lewinsky investigation, served in the Bush White House, and has sat for 12 years on the Washington, D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, where he's built a conservative judicial record. We're going to have a while to chew over his nomination. Hearings will likely be in September. So over the next few weeks on Left, Right, and Center, we're going to have a series of guests who can look at specific aspects of Kavanaugh's record and what it might mean for key areas of law and public policy. This week, we're going to look at the legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act, one of which was argued at the appellate level before Judge Kavanaugh, before it got to the Supreme Court. To discuss that, Nicholas Bagley, professor at the University of Michigan School of Law, will join us. Nick is a contributor to the health policy blog, The Incidental Economist. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Josh. How are you doing?
Good. So I believe you argued a case once before Judge Kavanaugh. What was he like as a judge?
Yeah, I was clerking when he joined the court and got to know him a little bit then, and then argued a case before him. He was immensely well prepared, you know, asked sharp questions, was, you know, committed to trying to get it right. He, as it turned out, ruled against me, so got it wrong in that particular case. But, you know, you win some, you lose some.
So there was this key case, National Federation of Independent Business versus Sebelius. This was the case that argued Obamacare was unconstitutional because Congress lacked the authority to require Americans to purchase health insurance. And famously, it's the case where Obamacare survived on a 5-4 vote in the Supreme Court because Chief Justice John Roberts decided the penalty for failing to have insurance wasn't really a penalty as such. It was a tax, and that Congress could impose a tax on people for not having insurance. Before Roberts made that decision, Judge Kavanaugh had written a dissent from an appellate decision where his colleagues had also ruled to save Obamacare. And I hear a lot of disagreement about what we can read into that dissent by Kavanaugh. You have some conservatives who grumble that Kavanaugh basically drew the roadmap that Roberts ended up following to get to that survives as a tax decision. I've also seen observers on the right and the left saying, no, we should look at Kavanaugh's opinion as a strongly anti-Obamacare opinion. How do you read it?
I think neither gets it exactly right. You know, his dissent in that case was really about the scope of a pretty arcane statute called the Anti-Injunction Act. And it's a statute that is designed to prevent courts from interfering in the imposition of federal taxes for all sorts of reasons you might sort of expect, right? Taxing is a really important function of the government. You don't want courts stepping on the IRS's toes. So we have an orderly process for challenging the constitutionality of taxes. You got to basically wait until it's assessed. And the plaintiffs in that case were seeking to challenge it well in advance of it being assessed. And in that case, Judge Kavanaugh said, hey, look, we don't have jurisdiction to hear this case at this time. Maybe we have a chance to hear it down the line, but we just don't right now because the individual mandate is a tax and thus is subject to the statute. So when I hear people on the right claim that this somehow laid the groundwork for the chief's ruling in NFIB, I think to myself, you know, do they think so little of the Chief Justice of the United States of America that he couldn't come up with this idea on his own, or that he couldn't read the briefs where the taxing clause argument was made sort of in compelling detail, or read the volumes of public writing that flagged this issue as well? I mean, it was a live issue in the case just because Judge Kavanaugh had a decision on a somewhat related but different issue, I think doesn't really tell us a whole lot. I should also say that the Chief Justice actually went out of his way to say the Anti-Injunction Act didn't apply to his review of the Affordable Care Act. So on the precise issue at hand, he disagreed with Judge Kavanaugh. On the left, I just don't see evidence for thinking that the decision represents sort of deep-seated hostility to the Affordable Care Act. I think the best evidence of how Judge Kavanaugh would have voted in the case is how people who are kind of like him voted in the case. And there are a lot of people who are associated with the Federalist Society or who are appointed by Republican presidents who felt that the individual mandate was unconstitutional. It wouldn't shock me at all to find out that Judge Kavanaugh was one of those people. But you can't see that on the face of the opinion.
So, Megan, Judge Kavanaugh joins the court, and we now quite possibly have five justices on the court who have a broad skepticism of the power of Congress to do economic regulation, who read the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which says that the Supreme Court may regulate interstate commerce. They read that more narrowly, maybe more inclined to think that certain things that the government has traditionally regulated are not truly interstate. Does this set up the court for a crisis of legitimacy? Because there are some decisions people are worried about, and Roe is an obvious example here, where if the court overturned its previous precedents, it would be granting more power to the legislature. And you could say, well, the court is making the system more democratic, letting the government make policy the voters wish. On issues like this, it would be going in the other direction. It would be the court taking power away from the legislature. You'd have people who are elected to implement a certain policy and the court saying, no, you can't do that. Is that a desirable thing?
Okay, so there are actually multiple things going on here, right? I mean, there's taking power. Do you take power away from Congress? Do you take it away from state legislatures, right? So something like Roe wouldn't necessarily give Congress any right to make laws about abortion. And I think probably they shouldn't have that right, right? States are capable of handling it themselves. It is a local issue. But on the other hand, something like Obamacare, you know, can you really do that at the state level? It's complicated who you're going to allow to legislate where, right? And so I think that, is there going to be a crisis of legitimacy? I think you're going to end up with a tension basically between two principles. One is federalism and put things back to the states, put things back to the legislatures, don't legislate from the bench. I think that is something that a lot of conservative jurists take very seriously. But at the same time, you're going to have something called stare decisis, which is basically the argument that once something has been law for a while, people have an interest even beyond having good laws. They also have an interest in having predictable laws. And you don't want courts constantly overruling past rulings from other courts, even if the rulings that they would overrule maybe weren't so good, precisely because it doesn't give people visibility into what the law is going to be in a couple of years. And that makes it hard to plan in all sorts of ways. I think on something like Roe, that is going to come up very strongly. On something like the Affordable Care Act, I think it's probably going to be decisive. It wouldn't surprise me to find out that Brett Kavanaugh did not want the Affordable Care Act to go through and sort of sided with what was apparently at some point a 5-justice majority that then turned into a 4-justice minority in saying that the law should be struck down because its interpretation of the Commerce Clause was way too broad. That said, it is hard for me to imagine that a justice swashbuckling in and taking down the ACA immediately. What I can see is if the ACA dies on its own, if it just sort of staggers along and it gets a little smaller every year, at the point where it's insuring, say, 3 million people instead of almost 10 million people, you can definitely see the court willing and also causing bad side effects in all sorts of ways, as we're now seeing in, for example, the unsubsidized insurance market. We've now got this weird situation where the people in the subsidized market are doing fine, the people in the unsubsidized aren't. If the side effects are bad enough and the coverage is small enough, you can see them taking it out. But it's very hard to imagine that they're going to introduce that kind of regulatory uncertainty in just kind of a whiplash way.
Liz, there's this interesting thing where some of the bigger ideas about healthcare on the left, single payer and such, actually have fewer of these constitutional problems than the Affordable Care Act did. Is this another reason that an incremental approach on healthcare was a problem?
Yeah.
So what are you hoping to see the court do here?
I mean, again, you're in harm mitigation, right? With any form of liberalism, you're always going to be in some stage of managed decline. And then this is an issue with the Supreme Court and the way it functions in our democracy. We have a dysfunctional democracy to begin with because it's run by capital. So your options for what you can choose for the choices on the ballot are delimited by capital to begin with. So, I mean, insurers, for example, were always going to be part of the game. They were always going to be big players and they were always going to win. So you immediately get screwed right out of the gate. And that's just how it is when you have your democracy delimited by capital.
Nick, I mean, are we looking at one of several things that sort of bogged Obamacare down, or are we going to have to come back sort of regardless of what the court does and do something bigger because of these, you know, these deaths by a thousand cuts?
Well, look, I mean, health policy, fortunately for those of us who do it, never dies. And there are always problems that cry out for resolution. What the particular problems will be in 2, 4, 10 years, I don't know. What I can say for sure is that the Trump administration is engaged in a campaign to undermine, or if you'd prefer, sabotage big parts of the Affordable Care Act. And the cases that have been brought to challenge those efforts to undermine or sabotage, some of them are now working their way through the courts. Others will be brought in the coming years. And so I think Judge Kavanaugh's influence on the debate over health reform isn't going to be kind of the level of big ideas or uprooting the Affordable Care Act root and branch. It's going to be in the more quotidian work of ruling on agency actions. And there, I think his influence could be pretty important. You know, we have lots of good data suggesting that Republican judges are more sympathetic to agency actions that come from Republican administrations and vice versa. And so I'd expect that Judge Kavanaugh will be temperamentally inclined to support many of these Trump administration efforts.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig and Megan McArdle of the Washington Post. We will be back with Annie Lowry to talk about giving people money. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Megan McArdle, columnist at the Washington Post. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, also a columnist at the Washington Post. Now it's time for It's Been Busy. Lately, we've all been so busy following the latest Trump news that some important events and ideas may have fallen through the cracks. So I want to take this time, step back, and talk about a very big idea, a universal basic income. The idea is the government would send a periodic check to every American, or perhaps to every American adult, simply for existing. It would be enough money to live on, but not enough money to live very well on. The idea would be to end poverty, eliminate the need for more specific welfare programs, make workers less vulnerable to the whims of the labor market, and ease choices like staying home to care for a child or an elderly parent. Of course, this would be extremely expensive. The reporter Annie Lowry is here with us. She writes about economic policy at The Atlantic, and her new book is called Give People Money: How a Universal Basic Income Could End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. Hi, Annie.
Hey, everybody.
Thanks for being here. So you suggest a UBI of $1,000 a month a person that would cost something like $4 trillion a year. To put that in perspective, that's about a fifth of U.S. GDP. It's about as much money as the federal government currently spends on everything that it does in total. And something like 20 times as large as the cost of the recent Republican tax cut bill. So you could repeal that tax cut and you'd be about 5% of the way to paying for a UBI. So I know this is the boring place to start, but I think, you know, the big price tag, I think, is the biggest barrier to implementing a UBI. So can you talk about how do you pay for this? What are the economic and social costs of the things you'd have to do to pay for it? And how do you compare that against what would obviously be enormous benefits from people receiving all this money?
Yeah, I mean, so I actually don't think that this is a good idea or a great idea or kind of like the low-hanging fruit here or like the most important thing that we could be doing as a government. It's, you know, that's kind of it's the standard UBI proposal that people make, $1,000 a month, which would just about keep you out of poverty, depending on how big your household size was. But I think it's instructive to think about, basically. The whole book is this kind of thought exercise about thinking about the ways that we could do things differently. We're not so constrained in terms of cost. Like, again, I just don't think anybody is proposing the $1,000 a month. Well, people propose it, but I think it seems so distant that it's kind of better to think about it as being like, what would that do? How would we pay for it? What would be more proximate, maybe marginal proposals that might do more good, have more bang for the buck?
Well, but so what are those? What does this mean in the context of the U.S. political situation?
If
we read this book and you talk a lot about, you know, how the nature of work is changing, these experiments showing how greatly the lives of people in poverty are affected when you just give them cash that lifts them out of poverty. If the lesson is not UBI, what is the lesson about what we should be doing?
Make things simple. do them in cash, if that makes sense, right? So I'm not sure that getting rid of Medicare and Medicaid and replacing it with cash is a good idea. People really do need insurance. But like food stamps, you know, we know Social Security works really well. It's just cash. EITC works really well. It's just cash. Whereas, you know, programs like TANF, which is the kind of classic welfare, really don't work very well. It is a cash grant, but it comes with lots of strings attached. It's a really hard program to use. It's actually pretty expensive for states to administer. So making things universal, having fewer holes and requirements, making programs simpler, all of these are good ideas that are really practical, right? And I think that there's kind of a tension between, do you want universality? Do you want everybody to get the same thing? Because that tends to make things popular. So Social Security being the classic example here. Or to what extent do you need some means testing to make sure that things are progressive enough? There's a tension there. But nevertheless, I think that you could see doing something like getting rid of TANF and just making a grant to poor kids. Like that would be a good idea.
Liz, one of the questions that always gets bound up in this, I think in conversations both on the right and the left, is about money and the relationship of work to society, and basically how much grants should be conditioned on work from people who are able to work. You have this ongoing debate on the left about whether a UBI would be a good idea or whether you should instead have the government guarantee employment to people so that people could support themselves through employment. How should we think about the role of work here? Because I think one of the big objections that you get politically to this is people say, well, if you give people this grant, then they won't have to work. It'll go to people who are lazy, or it'll reduce the overall labor force. It won't be fair. Things of that nature.
Well, see, this is a multi-layered question.
Yes.
And so, I mean, on one hand, you know, you can look at production and distribution as the two, you know, components in an economy. Do we have enough production? Currently, we have enough production. We are not underdoing it on production. We have enough stuff to go around the United States.
Isn't that a matter of opinion? I mean, people want economic growth. Doesn't that just mean more production every year?
Yeah, I think we're doing okay in terms of wealth. But even if you want to add production, say that you want to do a little bit more production, there's room for that. You could be doing more production. It certainly isn't the case that we're underproducing to the point where people are like dying. People are dying on the distribution side of the ledger. Right, it's not on the production side of the ledger. It's not like the stuff simply isn't there. It's simply that it isn't getting to the people who need it, right? And so, I don't actually think that people not working is that big of a risk. People appear to want to work or have reasons for working. So then the question becomes, so if people had a universal basic income, what would be the cause of their departure from the labor market? Would it be out of sheer laziness? They don't want to do anything? Actually, that doesn't appear to be that common. Would it be because of seriously inhumane conditions in the labor market because the things they're doing are horrible and they really don't want to be engaged in that kind of labor? It's degrading and it's possibly hurting them badly. If that's the case, then these allowances for them to leave the labor market are good and are very similar to when we gave kids school and took them out of the labor market, for instance, and decided this is just too dehumanizing, degrading, and dangerous to leave kids in the labor market. We're taking you out of it. This would be similar to that. There are just some jobs that we're asking people to do right now that are dehumanizing, degrading, and dangerous. And so their departure from the labor market is actually a good thing. And then there's, you know, other reasons people might be leaving the labor market are changes in the labor market, automation. Their work is basically make work, right? I mean, the labor market is changing, technology is changing, and so the way that people work is changing. In that case, it's not going to actually affect production all that much when they leave the labor market or when they reduce working time, right? It's not all or none. Sometimes it's just reduce working time. And so I don't think it's actually, are we going to have an apocalyptic everyone stops working thing? By the way, I think that would be great. Full automation would be fantastic. Full automation with full production, everyone getting their income just from the production of machines and never working and instead creating art and building communities would be wonderful. I think that would be great.
Well, an end to scarcity would be awesome.
But I mean, working towards, you know, a technological solution to work would be great. And I think the fetishization of work is a problem. And I think it happens rhetorically in these job guarantee conversations because you essentially stumble into the rhetoric of workfare, which you were in 96 welfare reform.
Megan, on and off, there's been some amount of support for versions of this proposal on the right. Charles right. Murray from the American Enterprise Institute has proposed one. Milton Friedman used to talk about a negative income tax back in the day. You see some libertarian utopian tech founders talking about the desirability of this approach. What's the appeal here for the right, and does that appeal extend to you?
I think the appeal is multifold. I mean, so first of all, there's definitely, at least in the libertarian strain, a real disapproval of the kind of paternalism of things like food stamps, right? It's like, if you want to give poor people money, give poor people money. Don't, like, nanny them about how they're going to spend it, right? So that is part of it. They're less costly to administer. They don't create a large regulatory, bureaucracy that then develops lobbying power to increase its size and its programs, right? So I think for all those reasons, they can be much more efficient than the bigger means tested or sort of in some way, the narrow programs. The problem with that is that there's a big blink moment with all of these proposals, and with due respect to Charles Murray, who I think, sincerely tried to do a really good job on this, and other people. Is that, here's the thing, like, if we give everyone $1,000 a month, some disabled person who needs an enormous amount of medical care cannot buy, with Obamacare and so forth, they cannot cover all of the things that they need. It's not just the insurance, it's the home health care aides, it's the special van to help them get around and so forth. And so you have people who are really needy, and then people who aren't needy at all. And if you spread the amount of money that is, I think, plausible to get out of the United States government over everyone at exactly the same rate, you're going to end up with the people who are desperately needy being underserved. And so I don't support it. I think there are a lot of reasons not to support it. One is that I will actually step in and say, every time we talk about UBI, they'll do art, they'll do community organizing. We know what people do when they're not working. We have time use surveys. It is not doing art. It is not community organizing. They watch television. They watch an enormous amount of television. They play video games. Now, maybe that would be different if we had a UBI and we had like 100 years to create a culture, but we should not assume that. I think a lot of people who talk about the UBI, they model it, their idea of what it would be like on the one community of what a work-free world would be like on the one community that they are familiar with where that was true, and that is a college campus. That is a highly selected, extremely artificial environment that is not what communities would look like. Jobless communities in general, where people are home and on benefit, do not look like happy places to live, and they do not look like a flourishing of art and community organizing.
Well, this is like based on a medieval understanding. I mean, the socialist line that if people didn't have to go into the factory and pound out widgets for hours every day, they would do something more useful or at least more personally satisfactory with their time has been around since the 19th century.
I know.
This isn't a university produced line. This is in Oscar Wilde. I mean, this is in the medievalist Christian socialists.
We can observe what people do, however, and it is not like what people describe when they sort of lay
out. You have a pretty unusual population. People who are living on benefits right now, they're an unusual group of people, right? I'm not sure, which is not to say that I think that, again, I'm not saying that I know what people would do if everybody would have this. But, one of the ideas within a UBI is that you wouldn't be giving people so much money so that they could do nothing.
You describe in the book some experiments, some with very low-income people in Kenya, some small experiments with people in higher-income countries. I mean, what do people do when people who are not adjudicated as disabled, people who are just selected randomly to receive some sort of unconditional income, what do they do differently?
Right. So if you look at the Syme-Dime experiments, which these were done in the 60s and 70s in the United States. So this was not actually a basic income. It was a negative income tax that was bringing people's income up. Or if you look at the Mincome experiment, which was done in Canada, which they took a whole town and they kind of eliminated poverty with, again, like a negative income tax type thing. People did decrease work effort, like significantly. But not a lot of people stopped working. And when they did stop working, it tended to be the parents of young kids. It tended to be older people leaving the labor force a little earlier than they would have. It tended to be unemployed people taking longer to find a job, which is actually a good thing, right? It improves the match. And then people staying in school for longer. So you do, you see a reduction in work effort, but it's not really huge. We know that people's consumption increased, but the mix of consumption didn't change. So they weren't spending money on different things. They were just buying more of what they were buying before. And so, I think that you kind of have to ask the question, right? Like, if people are leaving the labor force for good reasons, and if they're going into labor that is just non-compensated, right? You're taking care of a kid, you're taking care of a parent, that's still socially beneficial. It's just not adding to GDP.
Right. And we do know from workfare studies that took place during the welfare reform efforts in the 90s that a lot of what Workfare did was just take mothers who were caring for kids and put them behind the counter at Arby's.
On the other hand, those mothers also did then end up having somewhat higher incomes than they had on welfare, and their kids had somewhat better outcomes.
For a period up until the Great Recession happened. It seemed like that stuff worked fairly well in a normal economic condition. Right. And then when the bottom completely fell out of the economy, it didn't work anymore because there were no jobs even if they wanted to work.
You know, we have a comparison between TANF and the EITC, right? The EITC, which is kind of more of a carrot effort than a stick effort, worked a lot better.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I would note that TANF does seem to have made people, the work requirements do seem to have made people hurry up and get a job faster, but it doesn't change employment rates overall after a 5-year or 3-year time horizon. And it increased extreme poverty, right? Like, we also know that that's true. And so I think that you see some Republicans now who look at TANF and are remaking the entire safety net and its image, saying this worked great. But, like, making a single mom get a job 3 months earlier than she would have otherwise, like, that's not great. That's not an awesome outcome.
And then pay for childcare out of that minimal wage in an urban area.
We're going to have to leave it there. Again, the new book from Annie Lowrey is called Give People Money. We have reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Megan McArdle, it's your soapbox.
Robert Nozick had a joke about normative sociology, which was the study of what causes of things ought to be. I think we're now in a situation where we're with normative policymaking, where we're looking for what the solutions for things ought to be rather than what actually is. And I think you see this on the Republican side with a huge amount of stuff that they're doing with immigration and certainly with what Trump is doing abroad. I think you see this on the left as well. And, you know, we should separate the idea that someone who caused a problem is also the person who can fix that problem and be a little more reasonable with each other.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Don't fetishize rules. Or if you do, do it in a morally sound way, as a sexual perversion, where you're literally fetishizing rules. Measure what people are doing against a substantive account of the good if you can't mind your own business. But don't drop a dime every time you see somebody breaking a rule just because it's a rule and it's been broken. People are leaving work at 3, or if they're watching the World Cup on the job, or if they're selling water or candy or whatever they're doing without a permit, resist the urge to call the cops or their boss or whatever, whoever you think will set them straight or ease them up. You are the problem. Let people do their thing. Do not fetishize rules.
For my rant, I just want to note that we did not talk at all about the Peter Strzok hearing on the show this week because it was extremely stupid. You're welcome. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Megan McArdle, Elizabeth Brunig, Tom Nuttall, Nick Bagley, and Annie Lowrey. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.